Again, if you would move in, and if there are empty seats in your row, move in so that the seats will be at the edge so those people standing in the aisle can get in more easily. In that regard, it maybe conveys messages to us, and we actually get, maybe not so consciously, even unconsciously, messages of a philosophical sort through the architecture. So last time we were talking about, you know, periods of history like the Renaissance or like the mid-20th century, where society was all about, look, we can figure this out. We're in command. We're in control. We want order. We want clarity. We want analysis. We want, you know, things to be in the right place. And order was the rule of the day. And the architecture began to say that about that society and to really communicate to people within the culture. Yeah, it's about order. We as human beings, we can think. We're logical. We're in control. We create order. And so we get these buildings that are very profoundly about order. And then we could look at other periods. Sometimes, like right after that period, people get a little disillusioned. Maybe that's not all so clear. Maybe we're not totally in control. Maybe the nature or other forces are more powerful than we are as human beings. And you begin to get a little more complexity. And you begin to get buildings that reveal a more complex view of the way the world works, and that's palpable. Consciously or unconsciously, it's palpable in the buildings. And it makes us think about who are we as human beings, and, you know, can we solve problems perfectly, or are they always going to be a little bit off? And then the third thing we talked about was how buildings convey technology. And sometimes it's just building technology. What is it made out of, and how does it put together? But sometimes it also is just a notion about the role of technology in the culture. Oh my God, making a whole freaking art museum, maybe the most important art museum showing contemporary art in the entire world, the Centre Pompidou in Paris, and what is it about? It's about technology. Even arts? Oh my God, even art is dominated by technology? And that's a message being given in the 1970s, and by now, well, of course, art and technology are like this. But in the 1970s, the building was provoking. You know, here's a new idea. How about art being about technology? Also, how about art being about for everybody? It's like a freaking, you know, supermarket. It's not a pompous, you know, clear order. It's kind of a crazy, wild building. It says something about the role of art in culture. So these are intellectual messages that are being conveyed. So at the end of that, the Twitter card question was asking you, can you see in the environment around you buildings that maybe suggest order or suggest complexity or suggest technology? And these are some of the responses. So these are buildings that talk to us about order. Someone says, the Texas Capitol building has order. The building is symmetrical with a circle in the center underneath a large dome. I think that the order is also a reflection of the building's function as a place of legislation, law, and governance. Now, this is giving you a message about your freaking government, that it is orderly, it's powerful, it's clear, it's stable. Now, if in fact that building were, let's say, instead of that building, let's put the Centre Pompidou down there, and say, okay, state government's operating in the Centre Pompidou. What do you think? Would that give you the same sense of what state government is about? Would that ever happen? No, 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 that's not the message we want to convey about what our government is. That building is telling you something in your head about what state government is. And whether you're conscious of it or not, even you, as a little bitty third grader, with all your little third grader friends, get off a yellow school bus, go in the Capitol building, and you get a message about what is government. Here's one house over here and the other house over there, and we got the dome in the center, and it's strong, and it's simple, and it's clear, and it's symmetrical, and it's bold, and it's about an order and a dignity that is invested in state government. Perfect observation. Way to go, whoever wrote that. Okay, other examples of order. Let's see. Somebody says, the tower here at UT shows order. The location is central at UT, and it's aligned to the Capitol. It also has symmetry as the steps lead up to it, and it ends in a clock at the very you head to class. Again, what does it say about universities, about this university relative to the rest of the state? All of those messages are in the form of the building, and they're being conveyed as you go by. That landmark tower giving order to the whole campus. Let's see. Someone else says, the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, that's in California, is comprised of two identical wings, each of which is composed of five identical towers. This makes the institute appear very orderly and purposeful, which is fitting since it's a place where important research in science is conducted methodically. Very good point. So some people found technology. The Denver Airport expresses technology because of the extreme engineering used to construct the building. The tent-like structures would only be made possible by a new and futuristic kind of material created in the 20th and the 21st century. So yeah, it's these soaring big tents, tensile structures, very innovative, very technologically sophisticated. It says that's what this era is about. That's what Denver's about. That's where we're going. We're, you know, advancing technologically. Somebody else says, when I visited Alabama on a college visit, they had a new engineering building where on the inside in the hallways, the building systems were exposed and color-coded. This is similar to the idea of the Centre Pompidou and was meant to show the student engineers how the building works in the place where they themselves would be studying those systems. Yeah, here's what we're studying. Think about it. Go out in the hall. This building has systems. Think about it. How is it heated? How is it cooled? How is the water moving? How is electricity moving? Again, in that case, kind of pedagogical messages being carried by the technology of the building. Okay, let's look at an example of complexity. Someone says, the Facebook headquarters seem to have the quality of complexity. The inside is an open space and people and furniture are arranged in a free configuration with little order. This is a brand new headquarters for Facebook in Silicon Valley in California. The architect is Frank Gehry, who we're going to look at a little bit today and on Thursday as well. And yeah, it's a kind of freewheeling, complex kind of space. And that's appropriate for Facebook, this freewheeling, complex network interface of, you know, millions of people together. Finally, someone says, the Eiffel Tower makes me wonder about complexity, order, and technology. The precision of the material of the tower makes me ponder about the use of technological advancement that was used at the time. The beauty of where it is placed makes order essential to its complex beauty. Again, that's a really good observation. The Eiffel Tower was a huge technological feat. It was designed by the great engineer Gustav Eiffel, and it was meant to demonstrate their ability to build this really tall tower out of steel, brand new material. So it is technology, but at the same time, it's order. It's very, very precise. and it was on an axis, and you know, it was very orderly. And yet it's also super complex. All those little pieces of steel put together almost like filigree, like a spider's web. And when you get up close, it's zillions of tiny little pieces and very complex. It expresses order, it expresses complexity, and it expresses technology. Okay, so today we're gonna do the first of a kind of pair of lectures that says, where does architectural form come from? What is the inspiration for architectural form? And today we're gonna be talking about inspirations in nature and biology and organisms. How does architecture learn from the natural environment? And then we're gonna have a second lecture that looks at mathematics, geometry, and actually on your course outline, these were flipped. I've reversed the order of them for other reasons. But today we're talking about nature, biology, and organisms. And there's a message in that. There's an intellectual message if we say that our buildings are coming from nature. It's a reverence for nature. It's a respect for nature. It's an integration with nature. Is it possible that we make built environment that is a very easy flowing extension of nature or the natural environment? So, whoops, Sadie, this is not advancing again. I'm going to say there are four reasons why one might use nature as a provocation for building. Four reasons. The first one is that often we work with materials that have natural characteristics. So we may be building out of stone, or we're building out of wood, or we're building out of materials that are found in nature. And so if we're using them sensibly, we're probably using them in a way that nature would use them. And so it's just sensible because materials have natural characteristics. So that's one provocation. A second provocation is that, there are natural forces that work on buildings. So the wind is a natural force, and it makes certain shapes that work well with wind or resist wind in a bad way. Gravity is a natural force that works on buildings. Rain is a natural force that works on buildings. So if we're trying to get the rain off of the building, we might want to be in concert with those natural forces. So materials are one reason. Natural forces are a second reason. A third reason a building might take on these more organic forms is that actually the way we move and the way we operate and our behavior, our activities, they actually have a kind of flow to them. When we walk around, it's not like we're soldiers and we do right angle turns. No, we tend to be just the way we move. We move in a more fluid, more dynamic, more natural kind of way. And so if we're functionally responding to the way human beings move and occupy space, that might make more natural forms as well. And then a fourth and final thing is that if we say architecture is meant to accommodate us and our uses, our bodies are natural organic shapes and forms. So if we're going to make something to sit in, well, that ought to have something to do with the shape of our butt, which is organic. Pretty much anything we interface with, our body, our physiognomy, those are natural forms. So those four reasons: because we deal with materials that have natural characteristics, because we have natural forces like gravity and rain and climate that we need to deal with, the movement of human beings and often behavior and function is a fluid, natural kind of form. And the fourth thing is our own physiognomy. Our bodies are natural forms. So let's look at some examples of this. So there are two at the beginning here, two radically different parts of the world, but they're both environments that are very much shaped by nature, biology, and organisms. So this one is in the center of Turkey in a region called Cappadocia. In fact, in the news these days, there's all these people moving from Syria to try to get to Europe, and they're going across Cappadocia. Cappadocia is in the center of Turkey, and some of the names of cities they've been talking about, they're in this central region of Turkey. It's a really beautiful natural environment. All of the geography here is this soft stone, very, very porous soft stone. And it's been inhabited since biblical times. It's ancient, ancient part of the world. So you can see these beautiful hillsides. And in fact, it's a natural material, stone. And all the weather, you know, the rain and wind, that's been working on the stone. And you see the shapes that have been created by the interaction of a natural material stone and the forces of nature in wind and rain and things like that. And you get these very powerful shapes and forms. This is nature making shape and form. And what happened when people inhabited that is they just went with exactly the same thing. They, in fact, did not cut the stone and build with it. They just hollowed out into the stone. So this stone is so soft that you can take a spoon and you can scrape. It takes a while, but you can scrape and scrape and scrape and scrape and scrape, and you can dig out volumes in this stone. So that's how people made their houses. And you can see these openings, and they're you go into the house, and there are various rooms inside there, and there are portals and windows, and they've simply hollowed their houses out of the stone. And they take very organic shapes. Why? They're just using the material as it's logically used, as it appears in nature and as it works well for them. They're using those shapes in the material. And they're also using things that have to do with their body and their movement. So these little niches, which are these organic shapes, they have to do with the length of them is about the length of your body when you lie down. And then you can sit up, and there's a ledge there that's about where your knee is, right there. And you would sit right there. And it's a place where you do all kinds of things. You might sit and eat there. You might lie down and, you know, sleep there. You might have a couple of you in that niche and have a little conversation. But it all has to do with the activity and has to do with your physiognomy. And no, it's not all right angles. It's more soft, curvilinear forms that have to do with the material and also have to do with the activity they're accommodating inside their very rudimentary homes. Now, that's one culture in one part of the world, a completely different culture in another part of the world. This is in Bangkok in Thailand, and this is tropical. You know, no stone anywhere here. It's basically tons and tons of palm trees and flat as a pancake. And this particular part of Bangkok they called it the Venice of the East. Only it was there as early as Venice was. It's just our Western prejudice that makes us say that. But it's all canals. All the transportation is by water. So the boats go everywhere, and their markets, as you can see here, are on the water. But if you look at the shapes and forms of things they're making here, these little, even houseboat kinds of forms you see on the left, the shelter above them is this organic form that has to do with getting the rain off, and that's a flowing movement to get the rain off and to keep the sun out. And it's made of little reeds that are woven together because they can strip those off of the palm trees and they can weave them together, and they make these very watertight kinds of mats out of that. But the material itself is supple and it bends, and so the shape and form has to do with the material. And it has to do with the natural forces of getting the water off of their boats, their houseboats down below. I love these hats the women are wearing in the slide on the right. Those are called a knob, G-N-O-B. And it's a wonderful combination of different forces that are making this shape and form. One is the shape of the human head, so it is the physiognomy of your head, which is not a circle, but a kind of oval shape. And then superimposed on that are it's trying to keep the rain off. Rains every single day here. There's tons of rain. So these big brimmed hats are meant to shed the rain off, and the shape of that has to do with getting the rain off smoothly. And then the third thing is they're also made out of these woven reeds and that sort of supple bending form. And you know, you bend it too much, it breaks, it's brittle. So you have to do it soft, curvilinear shapes and forms to make this. So again, it's materials and it's natural forces and it's human physiognomy that is now creating a form out of that. And these are at the small scale, but then you can see these same kinds of things happening at a larger scale in Bangkok. And in many cases, actually using bits of human physiognomy, mimicking those in the building. This is the Royal Palace. There are these funny little spiky things at the top corners of the buildings there. And those really come from a dance that the women do in Thailand. And it's a very sensuous dance. And they bend their fingers way, way back. And they have super long fingernails. And they're making all of these dance forms with that. But that shape is considered incredibly beautiful in the human physiognomy. And then it's mimicked in the architecture in these little shapes and forms at the top of the building. So it's finding something beautiful in the human form and then replicating that in the architectural form. And then they're what we would maybe call temples. They're Buddhist wats, sacred precincts in the royal palace there. These things, again, are these very organic shapes. And they, again, have to do with if you just take the mud in this part of the world, because, you know, they don't have stone or anything like that, so they often build in mud. And even the, like, ants and little critters, they build these mounds in their nests that are this shape. They're a little skinny at the top, and as the load gets bigger and bigger, they get fatter and fatter. And that is a very natural shape that gravity produces. When you take mud or soft soil and you try to stack it up, that's the shape it takes. So they can see that in nature, and that begins to generate the shape of the wat. But then also part of Buddhist ritual is to do circumambulation, where you walk around and you ring bells, and there are rituals like that. So the plan shape of the wat is that movement around. And so it's human movement that's generating the form. Again, it's these organic, natural forces. And then in the ornament of the building on the left, we get, again, physiognomy, human figures. We get flowers, things that are seen to be beautiful in nature then become a part of the building. Now, the point of all this is to say that it's entirely possible to think of architecture coming out of these natural characteristics of materials, natural characteristics of really understanding and going with natural forces in nature, and then also the movement in the natural, you know, way we operate as human beings and our physiognomy, and those can then generate architectural form. So we're going to concentrate for a minute here on a particular place and time when they got very infatuated with nature generating form. And we're going to start, as we have in the last two lectures, with nature generating form in painting, and then in furniture, and then in accoutrements, and then in architecture. And how does that kind of progress? So this began in the latter part of the 19th century in France. There were a bunch of painters in Paris. We talked about kind of this era with Edward Manet. But there were a bunch of painters. They were really sick and tired of this system of the salons and the competition and the rich fat cats kind of deciding what everything was going to be. And so this group of rebellious artists, they decided to move out of Paris, get out of town, start all over, and try to find something more authentic in painting. Some way to make form that was more, less frou-frou, less stymied by tradition, something fresher, newer, more authentic. So they all went out to this little town southeast of Paris called Barbizon. And there's a big forest there called the Fontainebleau Forest. And it's very, very beautiful natural scene. It has these shapy rocks, and so they painted the rocks, and it had beautiful trees, and they painted the trees, and it had a lot of, you know, animals and wildlife, and they painted all of those. And they were looking for something more authentic than just painting some fat cat's fat wife and trying to make her beautiful when, in fact, she's a pig. And that's kind of what painting had been like for them. Didn't want to do that anymore. So they went out to nature to try to find something more inspiring for their painting. And out of that came the Barbizon School, which was a very famous era of painting. And then from that came Impressionism and all kinds of other kinds of painting as well. But we're going to look at now, just maybe 20 or 30 years later, they're into this for a while, and a couple of different ways people were finding form in nature, understanding form in nature. So on the left, we have a painting by Edvard Munch, this very famous Norwegian painter. You may know him for The Scream, that crazy-ass, face that's, you know, on T-shirts and, you know, everywhere. Well, he also did this painting we see on the left called Starry Night. And it really is about the Norwegian landscape, which is a very, very beautiful landscape. But he's not just literally painting a picture of the landscape, but now he's trying to understand qualities of the landscape. So he's very interested in Norway, they have this, eternal dusk. It's like, you know, hours and hours and hours of not exactly day, not exactly night. And so he's got the sky and the water reflecting the sky, and this incredibly beautiful set of colors and light and shimmery texture that he's just getting from nature. And he's infatuated with the colors and the textures and the characteristics, the light characteristics of nature. And then he's also looking at how the coastline meets the water and the shape and form of that. He's looking at the fjords and the kind of hills that come out of the water and the shapes of that. And really, he's making a painting that's analyzing shape, color, texture, light, and nature, and making a painting inspired by nature. Okay, keep that in your head. Can we make beautiful things? We admire some beauty in nature. Can we find characteristics of that that we then borrow and reapply to make beautiful form in a painting or in a building? In the slide on the right, we have another painter of a decade or so later. This painting is called The Dream. It's by Henri Rousseau. Rousseau made this trip down to the South Pacific, and he's looking at these natural forms in this exotic jungle, crazy place that he's never experienced before, having grown up in Europe. So now he's in this exotic place, and he's looking at all the shapes of things here, these pointy shapes of fronds and leaves and plants and vegetation, and how those are sort of like the stringy shapes of her hair, and they're like the linear shapes of her legs and her arms, and they're like the snake over here that's slithering through the plants. So how about these long, skinny shapes that he finds in nature? Or he also finds these more rounded shapes, like the eyes of the tigers here, or the breast of the woman, or the fruit on the trees. And okay, there's another kind of shape there in nature too. And this painting is all about abstracting those shapes, finding commonalities between those shapes, and making a study of them in the painting of The Dream. Now, out of that comes a whole movement in Europe that we sometimes call Art Nouveau, where they're looking for a new art, a fresh art, not just replicating what's been there before. And they're looking for it in nature. So they're analyzing nature and looking for fresh new ways to think and look at making form. So you see in making furniture, in the slide on the left, this is a very interesting leg of a table. That leg of a table looks like an insect's leg, little bitty, skinny, delicate lightweight thing, and then as it goes and meets the tabletop, it thickens up and becomes a kind of joint, just like in an insect's body. There actually is a guy who was an artist, but he made jewelry, very, very popular in this period, made incredibly expensive, you know, diamond, rubies, emerald jewelry. His name was René Lalique. And René Lalique made all of his jewelry like insects, like spiders, and like, because he thought, oh my God, they're so beautiful. The way a grasshopper's leg works, that's really beautiful. So they're understanding nature, sometimes odd bits of nature like insects, and they're trying to say, you know, that actually makes quite a sensible leg for a table. It's strong and it's sturdy, and it thickens up where it needs to make a joint, just like it does in the insect. You begin to get in the Art Nouveau period all of these pieces of furniture that are now very fluid, very organic, really inspired by natural form. I love this one on the right where it's like a door pull. And it has the grain and the wood. I told you, materials, very inspiring here. So wood has a grain to it. And then they shaped the pull so that when you're pulling it, you're pulling it as if the grain of the wood is just pulling out from the surface of the wood itself. So it's very integral to the natural characteristics of the material. And then you get these crazy-ass pieces of furniture that look like they could walk across the room, maybe a little over the top sometimes, but you know, and they did everything, furniture, trays, accoutrements, they did light fixtures. So the very famous Tiffany light fixtures in New York, very much a part of this Art Nouveau movement. And Tiffany would look at flowers, like on the right. It's like some kind of stem going up, and there's a nice blossom at the top, and that's the light fixture. Or on the left, I love this one. This is like Texas. It's freaking prickly pear. So it's a light fixture that's like prickly pear, and the pears and the blooms are the light fixture. But again, super inspired by nature. Now, okay, what are the architects going to do about this? It's one thing to paint it or to make something this big, but can you really make whole buildings that are inspired by nature that have these forces generating them? So there's this guy in Scotland who he's thinking, well, yeah, maybe we can do this. And so he starts by really analyzing natural forms that he admires. This guy's name is Charles Rennie Mackintosh. And on the right, these are drawings he did of lilies. He was completely infatuated with lilies. He even did a book on lilies. And he did it as a kind of biological study. He's understanding exactly how the stamens and the pistils and the petals and the everything work together. And he's and the shapes and the forms and how that works in a lily. And then in the slide on the left, he develops wallpaper for one of his projects in Glasgow. And he takes those delicate, sinuous shapes that he could find in the lily, and he begins to make form out of them. And then he takes that one step further, and he begins to make furniture that has these attenuated, long, thin, elegant, delicate shapes and forms in them, in chairs and in silverware and in other things he was designing at the time. Another guy, very much a part of the same Art Nouveau movement, is named Hector Guimard. He's over in France. And he's designing the entire subway system for Paris. The Paris Metro was just being put in at this time. And Hector Guimard designed all the Paris Metro stations. And he designed them. A lot of times they were interfacing with nature, as in the slide on the right. The subway's coming out into a park, and he makes this subway station that's very delicate, very light, almost looks like it could be a spider's web there, but splayed and curved. And on the left, we have one where now it's in a little more urban setting, but it's like some kind of stem and a flower up here that's the light. And the whole thing, again, He's discovered that, you know, we're making this out of metal, cast iron. The metal starts, you know, heated, hot, liquid. Well, we could just keep it flowing and liquid and make these shapes and forms that were more like the liquid quality of the material when it's hot and when it's being shaped. He begins to really make buildings out of it, not just little pavilions for the metro, but he begins to make apartment buildings in the 16th arrondissement in Paris, where the shapes and forms are, yeah, they're traditional. Those are columns. That's an arch. We understand that as traditional forms. But now it's kind of got vegetative forms wrapped around it. And when you go to the gate inside that opening, that's what that gate looks like. And again, it's made out of this liquid metal, and it's very sinuous and flowing. And now he then begins to make other apartment buildings where, yeah, we don't need a rectilinear opening. The way people move is not rectilinear, and the way our bodies are is not rectilinear, so we get a much more natural, organic, curved shape to the buildings. And then toward the end of his career, he even got this kind of, whoa, crazy notion. What if we just don't have any right angles in the whole building? It's just like totally organic and natural, like the plan on the right. And you'd just come in, and there'd be this central hall, and it would have a stair, and the stair would sweep you up to the upper levels, and it wouldn't be rectilinear. It would be sweeping and curving. And then even, you know, the rooms themselves would be lozenge-shaped or oval, or they would be much more like we move. Now, he never got to the point of actually building these because it was so unconventional. The whole idea of Art Nouveau was fresh, new. Is there a more authentic, a more real, a more tangible way of looking at how we make buildings that would really be like nature, and in that way superior to the fabrications of man? And the guy who really gets there is down in Barcelona, and his name is Antonio Gaudí. Very, very famous European architect of the time, probably the premier guy in Europe. And you know, sometimes we call Gaudí Art Nouveau, but sometimes we actually just can't put a label on Gaudí. Gaudí was just his own man. But let me tell you about Antonio Gaudí, and let me tell you about his ideas and why nature was so fundamental to him. So Gaudí was an extremely religious man. He was Catholic. And he felt like a fundamental part of religion and of God was nature. And he had a huge reverence for nature. And he was a very outdoorsy kind of guy. He loved to go hiking. And he knew the hills and the mountains around Barcelona very well. And he was a real connoisseur of nature. And he believed in nature. And he believed in it because he thought that was God's work. This is God in the most pure form we can understand it, is as exemplified in nature. Now, Gaudí was also extremely committed to his region. This part of Spain is called Catalan. They have a different language. They have a different culture, and now it's part of Spain. There still are separatist movements from time to time to try to get Catalan as a separate country. But he was very much a person of Catalan, and he loved the landscape of Catalan. He thought it was a very particular landscape. And he was very, very fond of his region and of his territory. So one reason why one might really concentrate on nature is to try to make your building sympathetic to their region. And Gaudí wanted to make buildings that were of Catalan, of this beautiful natural landscape that God made and gave to the people in Catalan. And this was not bullshit with him. This is an incredibly, incredibly devout guy. So this guy, at a certain point in his life, became a mendicant, meaning he sold everything he had. He was relatively well off, sold everything he had. He gave all the money to the church, and he became a beggar. He still would work as an architect, but he gave absolutely every penny he had to the church. And when he died, he had absolutely nothing because he had committed himself to be a mendicant. He was the most important architect in Spain by far, probably the most important architect in Europe, but he was so committed to his religion that he gave absolutely every penny he had to the church. So if you have these ideas, if you have that commitment to nature and to God, then what would that do in terms of how you design buildings? So this is an apartment building he designed in Barcelona. There's a new kind of emerging district in Barcelona, and this is a major landmark in that district. And he made what we call Casa Mila, this apartment building, and made it in a way that he felt like was an extension of nature and very much a part of the Catalan region. So several things we can think of here. Number one, Barcelona is on the Mediterranean Sea. Catalan has a long coast on the Mediterranean Sea. So one of the things he loved was the seacoast. And so in a way, he wanted to make, sometimes this building is called El Pedregal. Sorry, is that right? No. It's not exactly right, but it's something that sounds sort of like that. But it's a word that means like a bluff. So in a way, it's like a bluff above the ocean that the ocean might have pounded against for centuries and made these openings in it and made this irregular shape as the waves pounded against a big bluff of rock. And so the shape of the building on the outside is that kind of shape as if the seacoast had eroded it. And then on the inside, there are these two large courtyards that he described as sort of like a cave that the ocean had hollowed out of the building. And that became a courtyard for people's windows to look out on. And then all of the smaller rooms were like little subsets of caves that were off of those two major courtyards that shaped the building. So one huge, huge factor here is the seacoast and thinking of it as a rock that is eroded by waves. And then another big thing here is the mountains, because in Catalan, the mountains come down to the seacoast, and there is a mountain just outside of Barcelona, a very famous mountain called Montserrat, and what it really means is Montserrat, so serrated mountain. And the top of it is this serrated form. It's very, very odd, with sort of peaks, and peaks, and peaks, and peaks on this mountain. And so he knew this mountain really well. He would go, you know, climbing and hiking out there. And so he made the top of Casa Mila like Montserrat, where it's got these towers that come up from it, and it has a serrated edge on the top like Montserrat. So it's got the seacoast, and it's got Montserrat. And even on the rooftop here, he makes a kind of rolling landscape so that you can walk. You can take a stroll up there on the top and go up hills and mountains and down in valleys around these towers and get that more natural feel like you do when you're out in nature. So through the whole building, down at the bottom of the courtyard in the slide on the right, you have that hollowed out space, and then you climb up the stair here, and it's got that flowing movement up the stair. So yes, it's it is analogous to the landscape. It also is very much like the way human beings move, this very gracious flowing stair that takes you up through the building. Even the security gate here, it's like spider's web, these intricate natural forms that make it. The materials, which now is stone, it's made to look like stone does in nature. It's these rugged textures on the stone, these soft, curvy shapes like you find in nature, so that it really is analogous to what you'd see on the seacoast. And then the balconies that you see in the slide on the right, where people come out from their apartment, and then this balcony rail that's made out of metal. But the balcony rail is made to look like seaweed, as if the seaweed had lodged itself up on the rock, and that then gives you the security you need for the balcony rail. So he's sometimes almost literally, it's rocks and seaweed, but then you squint your eyes and know it's a building and a balcony. But everything all the way through the building is very much inspired by the nature of his region and of the place where the building's located. Now, these towers also play another function. So the building is air-conditioned in a very early and primitive way. It doesn't have air conditioning like we think of it, but it has a very sophisticated cooling system in the building. So the cool in these courtyards, they would be very, very shady, and down in the bottom of the courtyard would be cool air. It would come into the building at the lower parts, and then there's a ventilation system through the entire building that culminates at the top in these towers. And these towers are actually big ventilators. You can see the big openings in them where the air is moving. So it comes from the bottom, cool air, the warm air rises, it draws all the air from all the apartments. By the Venturi effect of air moving by these towers at the top, then a vacuum is created, and that draws the air up through the building. And it's amazing. I was there on a super hot day, and you could feel coming out of the register there this cool air that just by natural forces, by the Venturi effect, by warm air rising, he's ventilating the building and using the forces of nature to cool the building, but also to make forms of these towers that ventilate the building. So is it possible that we just completely, like Art Nouveau, rethink how do we make buildings that are completely in synchronicity with nature, that they draw their forms from nature, that they behave in concert with nature? We don't use fossil fuels and electricity and fans to move the air. We use natural forces, architectural forms, to move the air through the building and cool it. Shortly after he did Casa Mila, we have Gaudí moving just, you know, maybe a couple of miles away, right at the outskirts of Barcelona. They were building this new development, and he did a huge park in this development called Parc Güell. It's named after one of these famous families of Barcelona who owned the land and gave a lot of it to the city. So this is a public park. It's in beautiful landscape. We're in the foothills now, getting into the mountains that are on the outside of Barcelona. There's a very interesting, a big terrace that you can see right there. So he kind of takes the upper slope and stretches it out as a terrace. And then he takes the lower topography here and he pulls it in and he makes a marketplace underneath the terrace. So it very much is a building with the market down below here and the terrace up above. But those just kind of extending themselves out of topography in the landscape. And then the edge of that terrace is this wavy form that is exactly like when you look off in the distance and you see the coastline with the Mediterranean there, and you see the wavy form of the coastline. The building has the same shape as the coastline, and they're in perfect kind of harmony with each other. And so that big terrace is for festivals and parties. The market down below is where you buy your fruits and vegetables and meat, everyday part of the city. Beautiful tile work along this, again, a material that can be broken and shaped and take these loose curvilinear forms, not rigid, very, very flowing, dynamic forms. And then sometimes he even uses those tiles to make literal natural forms, like this is a little lizard. There are all kinds of lizards in Catalan, and they kind of love their lizards and their kind of mascots. So he makes a fountain here, and this is actually a drinking fountain. So, you know, it spouts out water out its mouth there, and the little kids come up and drink the water out of the lizard's mouth. And they think that's really funny, and it is, it's cute. But, you know, it's everything. Everything is coming from nature. I love these areas of the park. The slide on the left where you just look at it, and it It kind of looks like it's just a bluff on the hill. But in fact, this is totally man-made. All of those are stacked up stone blocks that are really rough texture to look like they're just the stone in the side of the hill. You go in between those, you can see that little board there. That's it's like a gelato place. And so this is like the cafe district in the park, but it's all out of natural shapes and forms and materials. On the right, in a way, sort of trees made out of these natural materials to make arcades and passageways through the park. Everything. He wanted to use forces of nature in a natural way. So he was not an engineer, but he was very interested in structures. And so he did experiments. Everything was about empirical learning. So a lot of these shapes and forms are very good structurally, but he would experiment with how can I distribute the loads in a way that I could see nature distributing loads in a cave or in a some kind of rock formation. So that he learned from natural forces and then determined from that structural principles and then built them, and they worked very, very well. So he didn't start with calculations. He started with empirical lessons from nature. Many of you will probably have heard of Sagrada Familia. This is this huge cathedral in central Barcelona designed by Antonio Gaudí. It was started in, I don't know, 1906 or something like that. They are still building Sagrada Familia. They're maybe 30% finished. It's a massive, incredible cathedral, but it's only 30% of what it's eventually going to be. But they've been building that all this time. And on structural principles, this is a badass, huge, huge, huge cathedral. And it's on structural principles that he derived from nature rather than from more conventional ways of thinking about science. Okay, so that's Antonio Gaudí, inspired totally by the nature of Catalan, of his region, of his place that he knew so very well. Now, there's another way of thinking about this, if maybe you just focus on the nature of a site, a particular place where a building goes. And can we draw a building right out of, especially a natural site? So this is there's a whole university campus outside of Helsinki in Finland. They moved the Technical University of Finland from Helsinki to this suburban campus in Otaniemi. And this was in the 1950s, 60s, 70s when they did this. At a certain point, they were going to build a new student union. It's a very beautiful natural site in Otaniemi. The site for the student union was kind of at the edge of the campus. There was a really beautiful forest on one side, and then the campus was on the other side. And they had a competition to try to find an architect and a design to build on this very beautiful natural site. And the winner of the competition were a husband-wife team, Raimi and Raila Pietila. And they drew their building very much from the site. So they observed three things about the site. They went out there, walked around. Three things struck them very strong. One thing is that there were all these granite outcrops from the ground. Big, huge, massive boulders of granite just jumping out of the ground all around on the site. And then the second thing was that then it was forested, but because it's these tall, skinny trees, like birches and pines, that have lots and lots of really attenuated trunk, and then they have all their leaves up at the top. And so it was actually pretty transparent at eye level through the forest with just all these vertical tree trunks. And then above that, there was the canopy, which was all green. And so they said, well, we should make the building just like the landscape. So at the base, we're going to have the granite stones, big boulders, outcrops. And then in the middle, we're going to have a space where you can see through, and that's where there's glass in the building, and it just has vertical lines in it. And then at the very top, it's going to be this green canopy, and in this case, it's a very big roof made out of copper, which weathers green in the climate of Helsinki. So here we can see again, there on the right, see those huge granite outcroppings there popping out of the ground. Those are done by nature. Then Rimanrelli Pietola come along on top of those natural outcrops. Then they put other stone to begin to make the building. And then there's a zone through here that is like that zone in the trees where all these vertical trunks have no leaves on them, and they're pretty transparent. And that's where the windows of the building are. And then at the top, you get the canopy like you get in the forest around. So the building is really drawn out of, and on one side, it's the campus, as you see here, looking that direction. And on the other side, it goes right into the forest. And you get that interface of the building being an extension of the forest and very much a part of its site. And even when you're inside the building, you know, they make planter boxes and that zone where you've got the vertical articulation of the mullions of the windows that are very much like the vertical lines of the trees outside. And then you have the ivy growing up those. There is this sense of continuity between the man-made and the natural, between inside and outside. Now, if you're in Finland in the dead of winter, oh my God, that is so refreshing. Finns love nature. It's a pretty sparsely populated country, so there's a lot of just natural countryside around. They're not a very urban culture. But then in the wintertime, of course, they're just blasted with all this snow and cold, so they have to be inside. But how wonderful to be able to be inside here, have some of the qualities of nature, even in nicer weather, that come inside the building, and always being connected inside to outside, as you see in the slide on the left, to nature beyond. And this is true all over the building. Slide on the right is in one of the dining halls where you see the rocks first, the sort of steady, hard foundation, and then this openness looking through the forest, and then the canopy of the building or the ceiling up above you. All the way through the building, every move inspired by the natural characteristics of that site. So, you can make architecture that comes out of a region and natural forces and characteristics of a region out of a site. I would also argue that sometimes you can make natural forces that come not so much from a site or a region, but from the more natural side of how we behave as human beings, a kind of natural function. So in this case, this is an airport, and it was one of the very earliest airports for transatlantic flight. So it was designed in the 1950s. The architect was Eero Saarinen, and this was the terminal building for TWA, Trans World Airlines. TWA was the first airline to make regular flights across the Atlantic. And this was, believe me, in the 1950s, this is a huge deal. Flying over the Atlantic on regular flights. I mean, it was done by Lindbergh, I guess, only in like the 30s. So it hadn't been very long ago that the first person ever did that. And now they're regular, you know, ordinary people can fly over the Atlantic. We take this totally for granted these days, but at that point it was like a miracle to be able to fly over the Atlantic. And the whole idea of flight was kind of a miracle thing. It was unbelievable that, you know, you could take this, it still is sometimes a little unbelievable, take tons and tons of steel and it's going to like fly. So this was a new idea. And so he's making a building that is about flight, that is about this miracle of conquering gravity. And it's also about this fluid motion of flying through the sky. So the building begins to look like some natural forms that fly, like birds that fly, or maybe even mythical forms like dragons that fly. And so you see the kind of wings of the building, and it's talking about movement or flight. It also is very much about the human beings arriving in a car, sweeping up to the building, emerging from the building, entering in, almost being sucked into the building. And then as you're inside being swept up and out into the airplane and into the sky. And the materials he's using here is concrete. Concrete starts as this mud, this soft, wet material. It's able to be shaped into these fluid shapes. And so he's making these fluid dynamic natural forms out of this liquid material. And hardening it and making it into this analogy to flight. And when you get inside the building, the same way. You're swept up through stairwells. You're shot out through tunnels, out finally to get onto the airplane and fly up through the sky. But again, now it's all about natural forces and movement and body physiognomy, those things inspiring the shape and form of the building. And that's very much the same thing that's happening here. This is a science museum in Wolfsburg in Germany. The architect is Zaha Hadid, very, very famous architect currently. She's, you know, had a huge controversy recently over the Olympic Stadium in Tokyo. Don't know whether she's going to end up building that or not, but it's been a tough row for her. But this was a site in Wolfsburg where people had been wandering across this site going from a residential area to the center of the city for ages. And there were crisscross paths. There was human movement in fluid, dynamic ways across the site. And then they needed to put this big building there, and they were a little concerned about people having to walk around it. So Zaha Hadid made the determination, okay, well, we won't make them walk around it. We'll make the building on the bottom floor. We'll lift it up, and we'll make all of these tunnels and passages and fluid spaces that go underneath the building, and people can continue to just walk from point A to point B and meander and move like they had before, and the building's not obstructing them. And that would then be the beginning of shaping the movement through the building so that you would then take off from there and move up through escalators and these curvy, windy spaces that take you up into the building. And then finally, when you get up in the building, this is a science museum primarily for little kids, and it turns into this very shapey, weavy space that is about surging groups of kids moving and flowing from one exhibit to another exhibit to another exhibit. And again, the shape and the form of the building is really generated by organic movement of people as they experience the space. And that's in three dimensions, sometimes climbing up a hill, sometimes looking down over an overlook, sometimes moving in and out of open spaces and closed spaces, but it's a very interesting, curiosity-invoking space for the kids as they move through that nature museum. Okay, the last couple of buildings here are going to be dealing with an architect who we're going to look at a little bit today, and then we're going to look at a lot more on Thursday. And this is Frank Gehry. Frank Gehry is probably the most well-known architect in the world currently. He's getting to be an old guy, but he's still very prolific. He's designed buildings all over the world. He's an incredibly successful and famous architect. This is one of the most important buildings he's designed. It's the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao in Spain. He credited a bit looking at Gaudí for some of the inspiration that he's had in his work. But I would say that this building, the Guggenheim Museum, is inspired by its region, it's inspired by its site, and it's also inspired by human movement. All three of those things are contributing here. So the region of Bilbao is a very famous shipbuilding region. They make vessels that go through the water, and that produces a certain kind of shape, fluid dynamics around those vessels. And so just a very short distance from here, there's a huge shipbuilding yard, and you see these huge ships being built and have been for generations in this area. So that's a little bit in Gary's mind. Gary also has, and we'll see this on Thursday, he has this huge fish fetish. Even since he was a little kid, he's just totally into fish. How beautiful fish are, those wiggly bodies. Oh my God, he's right. It's really beautiful how a fish's body works. It's soft and malleable, but it's also hard at the same time. And then it's got these scales, this wonderful texture on it that's shimmery and sleek. So he's in Bilbao is this huge fish center. This area is very well known for its cuisine. It's all a fish cuisine. The fishermen are, again, a huge part of Bilbao's economy. So this whole region is about shipbuilding. It's about fish. It's on the northern coast of Spain. So the building is drawing on some of these things about the region, the shipbuilding, the fisheries, and so on. And that's true in its shape and form. There even is a piece of it. This one is referred to as the Fish Gallery. There's this long, skinny gallery that comes out that's shaped like a fish. And then it's all covered in this kind of scales. The immediate site is right on the river that goes through Bilbao. And it's right at a curve in the river. And the building kind of takes the shape of the curve. It takes the water from the river and it replicates and makes a kind of basin up here that's a man-made waterway next to the building. And even the texture and color is like water. It's like shimmery, and you get that flowing quality of the river and the water that's on the site. So the fish and the river and the water and the boats, all of that seems very, very natural as a generator of the shapes and forms in the Guggenheim Museum. And then it also is, I think, generated very much by people from the city coming in here. You go down to the major entry right there, and then you come to a kind of mixmaster in the center here, and out from that are all the big galleries. And people are moving in a very fluid way from that center out to the galleries. That's that long fish gallery I was talking about out here to the right. And all of that is palpable when you get on the inside and you feel this dynamic movement and shapes and forms and leading you here and enticing you there. And it's all very natural to move through this museum. And it's exactly like the way human beings like to move. Okay, I am just one other building to look at briefly is the Disney Concert Hall. Part of it is not fluid. Part of it is offices. And you can see the rectilinear forms. But then part of it is about music, and it's about people coming to the concert and leaving from the concert and seeing and being seen. And it also has this amazing roof garden where you actually move up and through all these shapes and forms. And there are places, little concert places up there, little places to just sit and relax up there, but there's a whole roofscape on top of the Disney Concert Hall. And then inside, likewise, all the moving and surging and lobbies and then music, just somehow the shape and form of music expressing itself in the building. So, Twitter card question for today. So I want you to think again of a building you might have experienced that would have been inspired by nature or biology or organisms. Think of a building that might have been inspired by these things we've been talking about today. And I want you to tell me, was it inspired by something in its region? Was it inspired by something on its site? Does it seem like it really replicates the way people move or behave or act in it? Does it have something to do with materials it's made out of? What is it that's inspiring or shaping the natural characteristics of that building?